It's Philosophy Talk.
I'm so mad at you.
What kind of greeting is that?
What kind of daughter doesn't let her mother pick her up at the airport?
The kind of daughter who parks her car at the airport car park.
Yeah, but I'm the kind of mother who picks her daughter up from the airport, you know, with flowers and coffee and a fake chauffeur sign. Why would you mess with my sense of self?
Do we ever directly perceive the self?
Or is that just a fiction I created to make sense of a complicated world?
I've undergone a complex personal evolution wherein painful confusion has given way to what I like to think of as some degree of wisdom, culminating in my current Zarathustrian sense of self.
Is there really a constant unified self underneath all our perceptions?
Or just a bunch of changing ideas and thoughts?
It's true that we think that we have a self, but there just isn't any basis for it. It doesn't do any work.
Our guest is UC Berkeley psychologist Allison Gopnik.
Could 500 million Buddhists really be wrong?
Is the self an illusion?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
If you like Philosophy Talk, you might also enjoy podcasts from our friends at the IAI, the Institute of Art and Ideas. Check them out at iai.tv.
Is there such a thing as a self, something that makes you who you are?
Or is the self just a convenient fiction?
If we all stopped believing in selves, would the world be a better place?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I think I'm Josh Landy.
And I think I'm John Perry. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative, and where John taught philosophy for 44 years.
Today we're asking, is the self an illusion?
An illusion, John? If it were an illusion, who exactly would be deluded?
Your brain. There's no self in your brain. Look as hard as you want. You ain't gonna find a self in there. All you'll find is a series of perceptions, memories, and in some people's case, half-baked ideas, not meeting you, Josh, of course.
Well, speak for yourself, John. And I guess you're speaking for a lot of philosophers, too.
Whom do you have in mind?
Yeah, Hume. That's what I have in mind.
Hume is whom you have in mind. Okay, my favorite joke. Well, I take that as a great compliment. I don't agree with everything Hume said. But he had a lot of insights into the human mind, and you know, he wasn't alone. Some of the great Buddhist thinkers agreed that the self is an illusion, and I think for similar reasons.
Oh, you mean the whole chariot thing?
Oh, yeah. One Buddhist teacher, name escapes me, said that the self is like a chariot. All you have is stuff like wheels, axles, and reins. Just parts. Nothing above and beyond that. No essence. Nothing immortal. Same with your mind. There's only advertising jingles, dashed hopes, football results, the sound of the phone ringing because some Democrat wants money. No magic extra thing called a self.
Well, that's great for chariots, John, but, you know, chariots don't have memories of their childhood.
So what? I'm 77. I don't either. I barely remember last week or what I ate for lunch, or we haven't had lunch anyway. Maybe I was a chariot last week.
I doubt that, John. I think we actually do a decent job of accessing our childhood memories for the most part, and we have special access to them. I mean, other people can find stuff out about my childhood, but they can't remember it the way I can, and that's because I'm the same person. There's something that's persisted throughout all these years, and that's me, myself.
Well, as another great Buddhist teacher said, memory shmemory. Half of it is made up. Every time you remember something, you rewrite the past. Good luck getting a self out of that, Josh.
Well, okay, John, but consistency also works in the other direction. I mean, it's not just that I can remember how I was in the past. I can also predict, at least to some extent, how I'm going to be in the future. I can also predict how you're going to be. I mean, I am 99.9% confident that any moment now you're about to crack some off-color joke, hopefully not on the air.
Aha! Just wait and see what my illusory self decides to do.
Oh, I don't have to wait, John. I'm certain of it. And that's because we do a pretty decent job of predicting what our friends are going to do. And that, in turn, is because they have personalities. That there's something in them, John, that's relatively stable and that makes them do a lot of the things they do. Why not call that a self?
Well, okay, but for the sake of argument, I can predict that the sun's going to rise tomorrow. That doesn't make the sun a self.
Sure. Okay. But does the son worry about who to be with or what to do with its life? Human beings, you know, we're constantly making all these big decisions about our futures, and the way we make them often enough is by figuring out who we are. I mean, take me. Do you really think I should ditch my teaching job and sign up for the Ice Capades?
Give it a whirl. You might be good at it.
I really don't think I'd be too much of a hit on the ice.
Oh, I think before long you would make a big hit on the ice.
Fair enough. That's just evidence for my point. You clearly know me, John, and I know me. And that's why I can plan. I can make realistic decisions about my future, at least from time to time.
Well, it's good to pretend to have a self. It's useful to think of my future self as the same person as me. It's even useful maybe to think of that there's some kind of essence that carries through all these stages of the thing we call me. But really, at bottom, isn't it just a convenient fiction?
See, I knew you were going to say something like that. You're so predictable, John, and that's what I love about your wonderful self.
It's clear I have more work to do to persuade you of the truth, or to persuade some stage of you or part of you of the truth. And to help with that, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shereen Adil, to find out whether it's better to hang on to the self or let it go. She fileth this report.
It's funny going to talk to someone you've never met about the illusion of self, because as a radio reporter, the first thing we always ask is for people to introduce themselves.
How would you describe yourself?
Well, on the surface, I might say my name is David Michelson, and I've been a consultant for over 30 years. I'm a dad. That's probably my most important job and love of my life. And yet, obviously, that question is a much deeper question as well.
And that's the question that got David started on this journey. He says at first he was curious from a psychological perspective. What makes you, you? But then he began reading about Buddhism and practicing meditation. He even went to India to study with spiritual teachers. And 6 months in...
In a nutshell, on February 7th, 1997, I went to sleep and woke up on February 8th, and literally my consciousness was different. It was wild.
It was 3:30 in the morning, and he went outside and walked around, looking at the trees and the view below.
It felt like I was actually in a movie set. It was like, at one level it was real, and one level it actually, I experienced it as an illusion.
He says it's hard to find the words to describe it, but when he was back in the States, he found a teacher who could articulate what happened to him.
Up until you see beyond it, everything is dominated by oneself. I want to be enlightened. I want to have some spiritual revelation, which is really no different than I want an ice cream cone. I want to be loved. I like or I don't like.
Adi Ashanti is a spiritual teacher and founder of Open Gate Sangha in the San Francisco Bay Area. He studied Zen Buddhism, but he doesn't teach any particular tradition.
The fiction of self always keeps itself in the center of one's consciousness. And spiritual awakening is seen through the fiction of that, that there isn't actually a self in the center of one's consciousness.
As in, if you like vanilla and I like chocolate, where does that feeling come from? That's not what makes you you. It's just a reaction to a set of experiences. But I told David, honestly, it's a lot to wrap my head around. Why is it important to see the self as a fiction? Is it a complete abandonment of identity? I think that can be harder for some people than others.
I am deeply embedded within my identities as a Black woman, child of immigrants. There isn't for me in this moment any strong movement toward letting those sort of markers of identity go.
Chika Okoye is a practicing Buddhist who works at the Buddhist Peace Fellowship in Oakland. She thinks it's a wise teaching, but she's still in the process of questioning the idea of self or no self.
Yeah, some of the thinking I've been engaged with is to think about identity as both something that gives us power and something that may lead us into traps.
She says that for many disadvantaged groups, their identity can be a source of strength.
I've been to people of color meditation retreats, and those have been really deeply powerful and transformative experiences.
And while allying with people who've had experiences like hers can be empowering,
our end goal isn't just to feel safe and comfortable with our folks. in our lived reality, we are dealing with, you know, various types of harms that come to us as a result of these selves. And we have to heal it and transform it. And perhaps through that healing and transformation, we can get to the place where we can see through what about it is false.
At the end of the day, for Chica, what's important is to recognize that these realities are not personal.
Some painful thing may happen, and our tendency is to say, you know, my pain, my sadness, my anxiety. But there's another way to look at these things that's something more like, anxiety is arising in this mind or in this body.
Chica and David both said it's not about believing one thing. Their spiritual learnings are guided by their own direct experiences. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shireen Adib.
Thanks, Shireen, for that fascinating report. I'm John Perry. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. A brilliant assemblage of parts you are, Josh. And today we're asking, is the self an illusion?
We're joined now by Allison Gopnik, who's professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of How David Hume Helped Me Solve My Midlife Crisis, which is a fantastic article in The Atlantic. Allison, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Glad to be here always.
So, Allison, David Hume helped you solve your midlife crisis. Tell us how that happened.
Well, when I turned 50, as happens with many people, exactly what happened was that the sense of self that you rely on for long stretches of time without paying much attention to it kind of fell apart. So I got divorced, so I wasn't a wife anymore. My children, who had been a big part of my identity, my youngest child went off to college. I couldn't work, partly because I was stressed and anxious about all of these things. So my identity as a philosopher and a psychologist sort of fell apart. And in the course of that experience, I think an experience that lots of people have at one point or another, the way that I dealt with that was by reading and thinking. In particular, started out by looking at Buddhism and trying Buddhist meditation. My doctors sort of suggested it was a choice between sort of Prozac or yoga or reading about Buddhism. And I hated Prozac and I couldn't do yoga. So I decided reading about Buddhism was probably the best choice. And then when I started reading about Buddhism, I realized this reminds me of something. And the thing that it reminded me of course, was David Hume. So I went back and read a bunch of David Hume as well and was really struck by the similarities and the wisdom that both the Buddhist tradition and David Hume had to impart for this special case about trying to figure out who it was that you are.
So David Hume and various strands of the Buddhist tradition are taking aim at the whole notion of selfhood, but are they really saying the same thing exactly?
Well, of course, it's complicated because the Buddhist tradition is a very long, complicated tradition with lots of different strands and different arguments. But the way that I really helped to solve my midlife crisis was by going out and doing a bunch of historical research, the way an academic would deal with anxiety and depression. And the interesting thing that came out of that research was that, as a matter of fact, at the time that Hume was writing his great book, The Treatise, he was in a place in France, La Flèche, where there were among the very few people who actually knew something about the Buddhist tradition, particularly the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And there's a long, complicated, romantic, wonderful story about that. But what it comes down to is, especially if you look at someone like Tsongkhapa, who was the famous Tibetan Buddhist, the ideas that Tsongkhapa and Nagasena, who made the chariot analogy, talked about were sort of strikingly similar to the things that Hume talked about.
In the sense of a reduction to parts, right? We're only these sort of personality parts or self parts, but we're not a self as a whole.
And yet Hume has this beautiful passage, famous beautiful passage in the treatise, where he says, you know, I look inside of my head and I see thoughts and memories and beliefs and perceptions, but I never see this thing that's supposed to be in there, that's the self. And that's very much like the Nagasena point about going to see the emperor, and the emperor says, what do you mean you're not you? That's ridiculous. And he says, well, how did you get here? And the emperor says, The king says, well, I came in a chariot. And he says, well, but what is that chariot? That's the same way that I'm, that's the same way that I'm a self.
But you know, Ricoeur's answer to Hume's claim, right? Whenever I go and look at myself, I never see a self. I only see some perception or other. And Ricoeur says, what do you mean I? Mm-hmm. Especially combined with the words always and never. Mm-hmm. Like if you really weren't the same thing from moment to moment, how on earth could you add up all those different times that you went and looked at yourself into a general thought about what the self is? How could you do that?
Well, it's interesting that Tsongkhapa in particular, the Buddhist scholar, much like Hume, makes a distinction, and there's debates about this in the Buddhist tradition, but Tsongkhapa's view is, well, of course you think that you have a self, and it's even important that you think that you have a self, and in some sense it's real that you think that you have a self. It's just that that isn't tracking some metaphysical reality out there in the world, and if you recognized that, in a sense it's a real illusion, it's a real fiction, but it's still an illusion and a fiction.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're asking whether the self might be an illusion with Alison Gopnik from UC Berkeley.
Do you think the self is an illusion? Or is there a part of you that remains the same throughout your life and makes you who you are? What can we learn about the self from psychologists?
Selves, souls, and psychology. When Philosophy Talk continues.
So, Lady Gaga tells us that love can be a perfect illusion. Could the same be true of the self? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're asking whether the self is an illusion. Our guest is Alison Gopnik from UC Berkeley, author of The Philosophical Baby.
Alison, when you say that the self is an illusion, what exactly do you mean? I mean, we have this pronoun, self. I say Alison speaks for herself. Is some kind of illusory immaterial soul involved in a remark like that? Or some personality that has an essence that abides over time?
Well, I think, again, we think that we have a personality that has an essence that abides over time. But one of the things that's come out of psychology, this is part of how I got involved in this in the first place, is that a lot of those intuitions that we have turn out to be wrong or incoherent. So, for instance, if you think about the fact that we all think that we have an autobiographical memory, we think, well, I have a self because I remember everything that happened to me in a continuous line. It turns out that that's not true, that actually what we're doing a lot of the time is reconstructing our memories, and that when we were kids, when we were 3 or 4 years old, and I talk about this in The Philosophical Baby, we didn't even really have this idea of an episodic memory at all. We didn't have the idea that there are some special things that we know that are ours or the result of our experiences, and say what our mom tells us is something that isn't part of that experience. And in the same way, the idea that Josh was talking about the idea of having a personality, one of the things that comes out of psychology is that we don't really have clearly consistent personalities. Our personalities change all the time. And what we do has a lot more to do with the situations we find ourselves in than this mythology we have that we have a long-lasting single personal trait.
But is this mythology really part of our ordinary conception of a person or of a self? Or isn't it just something that a lot of people believe for, you know, religious, you know, religion tells us we got an immortal soul, but is that really part of our ordinary conception of a person or a self?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. How much is it that in our everyday life are we really caught up in ourself, or is it just in special circumstances that we invoke the self? Like when we're trying to make a long-term plan. So that's a context in which it makes a lot of sense to say, well, what will, you know, my 401k, not your 401k, John, look like? But a lot of times in our everyday life, it's not so obvious that we actually make a strong line between ourselves and other people.
So now, take the Dalai Lama. He's a Tibetan Buddhist, very proud of it, says it's a very naturalistic religion. And yet he also seems to believe in reincarnation. He believes that he's the 14th Dalai Lama, but he's also identical or the same person as the 13th Dalai Lama. Is this inconsistent, or is there some subtlety there that I'm not catching.
Well, I think, as I said before, you know, Buddhism, in the West, we often talk about Buddhism as if it's just, you know, a single thing. But it's a really complicated tradition, and it has a lot of religious elements, a lot of things that are believed as part of a religion, just like any other mm-hmm. religion. And then there's this philosophical piece that kind of gets pulled apart from the religious piece. And it's interesting that if you look at these Tibetan figures from the 17th and 18th century, they were really philosophers. They functioned like philosophers mm-hmm. rather than functioning as sages or religious figures. And that's, I think, where you see the most clear arguments about the self.
But when it comes to negotiating royalties on their books.
Yeah, there was a lot of hypocrisy. My favorite aspect of this hypocrisy is David Hume himself, right? He mounts this famous argument against the notion of selfhood. But what does he then turn around and do? Writes an autobiography called My Own Life, yes. right, in which he attributes stable personality traits to himself. He talks about his mild disposition, cheerful humor, moderation in all my passions. He wants to be appended as a preface to his collected works. So, I mean, does anyone actually believe this? Right? Hume says he believes it and then turns around and writes an autobiography.
Well, that's not quite fair. Because Hume says you go up in your study and you're a philosopher and you write down what you think you have justified belief in. But when lunchtime comes, you can't keep that up. You might jump out the window thinking you have as much real evidence that works as going down the stairs. Don't do that. You know, so I think he could legitimately say, look, when I'm discussing my royalties or writing my biography, I'm not just sticking to the stuff that I think is justified in my philosophical moments.
Well, that's sort of true. But on the other hand, it's interesting that Hume himself had what you could think of as an early life crisis. He was in his 20s, and he was thinking these kind of skeptical thoughts. And he, I mean, really did go through a psychological crisis. There's a letter that he wrote to a doctor asking for advice. Everything was falling apart. He couldn't make sense out of everything. He felt as if there was nothing that he could do. The doctors, instead of prescribing Prozac and yoga, they prescribed port and horseback riding. But the point is that when you read the book, when you read the treatise, he actually worked that midlife crisis, that early life crisis into the mm-hmm. book. So he says, God, I'm falling apart. I'm terrified. How can I function without the sense of a self and then and a sense of the real world? And then he says, no, wait a minute. Everything's exactly the same. And this is one of the points that the Buddhists make too. What have you lost as a result
okay,
of
but
losing
I,
the sense
I'm
of the self?
I'm worried about us having it both ways here, right? Because on the one hand, we say, we don't lose anything. Don't worry. There are no practical consequences. You might worry that it would cause you to fall apart and become like a patient with anterograde amnesia or something like that, where your life is really falling apart. You have no sense of who you are. But don't worry, it's just theoretical. But on the other hand, we want to say, you know, become a Buddhist, because these ideas are really powerful and they will help you become calm and connected with the universe and things like this. So surely we have to pick a side. Does it have practical effects or not?
Well, I think that's one of the interesting differences, although there's some debate about this among Hume scholars, between Hume and the Buddhist tradition. So the Buddhist tradition thinks you're not going to lose anything. Not only you're not going to lose anything, you might really gain things. You might function better in the world if you understand that the self is an illusion.
Just note, though, that there is, I mean, there's a little inconsistency in Hume's position that makes you think what he's denying is really some Cartesian view of the self, because he says the self is just a bundle. Well, leave out the just. That's a theory. The self mm-hmm. is a bundle. And there's a big difference between my bundle and your bundle. And he relies on it all the time in his theory of induction. The experiences that cohere and lead to his notion of causation, they're all experiences in a single bundle, right? I mean, let go of this doesn't mean people all over the world have the impression of it falling. It mm-hmm. just means that, well, anyway, so.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. You are a bundle of you listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're talking to Allison Gopnik from UC Berkeley about the illusion of self. And we've got a caller on the line. It's Ed from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ed. What's your comment or question?
Hi. Yes, I'd like to ask Allison about what's called an ipsaity disturbance. And so the basic layers of the self that have to be present for us even to get to the point where we can say that the self doesn't exist. And even how in Buddhism, it's a non-affirming negative in Tsongkhapa's logic where there isn't a no self. We don't say that no self exists. We have a self, and then we realize that it's quite porous, really. We don't impose no self. So that's my question.
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, you can see the complexities of trying to articulate exactly what is it that you mean when you say that there's no self. And Tsongkhapa goes into at some length about the difference between saying, as it were, there's a no self that's there versus saying it's not true that there's a self that's continuing, and it's not true in particular kinds of ways. And it's quite a tricky question about what does it mean to have an illusion of the self that's vivid and that's functional in various kinds of ways, even if you don't metaphysically think that there's really a self there.
So Allison, there's a tradition in psychology. Of course, everything I say is about the history of psychology because I so old, I just what I remember. But that says kind of describes what I would call a self-concept, but uses the word self for it, which is those things that you believe about yourself that you really can't quite imagine being different. So it's part of some people's self that they're of a certain gender. Others, it's not. It's part of some people's self that they're an American. Others, it's not. That is, they can easily imagine themselves not being an American or not being a woman or not being a man. And when you said your midlife crisis, it sounded like that was what was involved. You're thinking of yourself as a wife and an active mother, and all of a sudden, well, I don't know how sudden it was, but you couldn't think of yourself that way, and you were still a mother, but they're going off. So shouldn't some of these feelings be more accurate? This is our concept of the self isn't accurate, as opposed to the self is just an illusion.
It's just an illusion. So I think there's two pieces to that. One of them is that we do have self-concepts that are more malleable than we think. If any of you have seen the 7-Up series, which I think has the most recent version is coming. This is something where they tracked a bunch of children from the time they were 7 up until now. I think they're 64. And the remarkable thing about that series is you see some continuities, but then people's lives and who they are change in all sorts of unpredictable ways. What counts, what seems like it's central, doesn't become central. So another part of my midlife crisis was that I thought essentially heterosexual for my entire life, fell in love with a woman. And that was an example of something that felt as if it was a really deep, important part of the self that turned out not to be. And I think one of the things that's happening nowadays is people are questioning whether gender, which seems like an absolutely essential part of people's selves, is really that kind of immutable part. So I think there's one question about what are the things that actually hold us together. And then there's this other kind of more philosophical question about, for an individual person, is thinking of yourself as this individual self that's continuous over time, what are the benefits and costs of that?
So you might say the self isn't an illusion, it's a series of illusions.
Yeah.
You're raised, you know, to believe in an immortal soul, at least if you're raised in a Christian household. And then you have doubts about that, particularly if you go into philosophy or psychology. Then you thought, well, there is this self-concept, though, and then you kind of say, well, you know, that's really not essential, doesn't always obtain. As a matter of fact, usually...
I mean, all these things make
that's
sense.
That's not really a question.
All these things do make sense to me. And, of course, we do change, and sometimes we change radically. But there is still a question, first of all, of whether that change should be thought of in the way you said, John. You know, is the difference that I just didn't understand what I actually am? Right? I always was something. It was just an epistemological problem. I just got it wrong, as opposed to there never was anything there in the first place. And then there's a question for me, at least, of why is it so hard, right? If the self really were just an illusion, why couldn't we just say, bah, it's an illusion, and then it's gone? Seems to be a pretty stubborn one. And I wonder if it isn't because, in fact, there are at least some elements of who we individually are. For example, our capacities. Like, I'm never going to transform myself into a great musician, right? That's just a limitation, right? And other people are great musicians. So clearly, you know, there's a difference between me and, I don't know, Lady Gaga. I'm not going to be as great a singer as her, whatever I do. And it would be a mistake to think about myself. Either I am a great singer, or there is no fact of the matter as to how good a singer I am. So aren't there the constraints? It's not just situation. I mean, people say it's all about situation. If you find $10 in your pocket, you're going to be a good person that day. But I don't think Martin Luther King found $10 in his pocket every day. He was just a good person. So aren't there these stubborn constraints? You know, aren't there some facts about who we are that just resist this kind of, de-selfing?
Well, if you get back to John's point about your brain, right? I mean, there is a continuous story about those cells that are in your brain and those neurons that are firing, and you could point to them in a particular location and over time. But of course, on the other hand, those cells are all being replaced on a steady basis, and the thing that comes out is really different from the brain that I had 10 years ago or the brain that I'll have 10 years from now. So the question is, in some ways you can track, here's a continuous story about this brain, but in another sense the idea that there's some essence that's staying the same through that continuous transformation is a really different idea. So
I mean, I totally get that. I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just saying the replacement of cells isn't really, I don't think it's a very strong argument, because after all, our vision cells get replaced, but we still see.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about the components, about the organization. I think that's what's wrong with the chariot analogy. A chariot isn't just seats and reins and what have you, and horses. It's an organization of those things. And the organization creates an additional thing. If you just had a bunch of seats and horses, you couldn't get anywhere with them. But the organization makes it a new thing.
So,
and that's what gets replaced as the cells get replaced, just new cells.
Before we end this part, I just want to say, we've talked about philosophy, we've talked about psychology. How about literature? How about your man Proust? What insights does your many times reading his laborious 16-volume work or whatever it is give you about this?
Well, a couple of things. One, you know, he has a view that Allison does not hold, and I think she has some very good arguments against it, which is that we have special access to our own memories, and that special access, it's John Locke's view, that special access to my past, where I feel it from the inside.
Remembrance of things past.
Yep. Yeah. That shows me that I am the same person. I am a single thing. But he also had this idea of, so that's, you know, thinking about ourselves as it were, outside of time. But there's also the issue of the totality of our life experiences. And there, his thought is, think of it as a story. Think of the totality of your life experiences together as one story. And we might add that allows you to plan for the future, right? It also allows you to assess whether you think your life was overall a good thing. But we're coming up to break. I could be here all day talking about the wonderful Proust. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with UC Berkeley psychologist Allison Gopnik about whether the self is an illusion.
If you started thinking that you weren't really a self, would you become more calm, kind, and compassionate? Or would you just give up and sit on the sofa all day?
A world without selves, when Philosophy Talk continues.
What's so bad about a life of illusion anyway? I mean, you know, my life has been pretty good. If it's an illusion, well, you know, good for it. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your necessary illusions. I'm Josh Landy, and our guest is Allison Gopnik from UC Berkeley. We're thinking about the self as an illusion.
So, Allison, would the world be a better place if we all stopped believing in illusory selves?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. The Buddhist tradition certainly suggests that, and there's other pieces of data that suggest that. So there's some beautiful work that my colleague Dacher Keltner has done about the way that being in awe of something literally shrinks your sense of self. So if you ask people to draw a circle about how big they are compared to the other people around them, and they get to have an experience of awe looking up at a beautiful mountain or a redwood tree, they actually shrink their circle, especially with regard to other people. So they are less likely to think that they're somehow the center of the universe compared to other people. And that's probably a good thing. It makes them behave better. It makes them treat other people better. And that's one of the big points of the Buddhist tradition as well. On the other hand, if you wanted to know from an evolutionary perspective, why do we have this sense of a self? Why do we have the sense that we're continuous? If we're thinking about things like acting effectively or doing long-term planning or being willing to defer gratification. You know, I'm willing to save up for my old age, and I'm not really willing to save up for the old age of another, you know, female academic in her in her 60s. There's something about it being my old age that leads me to save, and you could argue that that's actually a good thing. Even our egos, I've argued about this sometimes with some of my Buddhist friends, you know, the intolerable egos that we know among those around us, maybe that intolerable ego is what you need to make a great scientific discovery, for example, that ends up doing something that makes lives better, like curing cancer, makes lives better for everybody around you, or to create a great new technology.
I'm intrigued by the suggestion that we get Donald Trump to stay out on the golf course all night long and stare up at the stars.
So how do we
solve
this?
That might help.
Yeah, nice idea. I mean, it's really vexing, isn't it? Because you've got, on either side, it seems like there are benefits both for ourselves and for other people. Right? On the Buddhist side of the ledger, you've got, you know, becoming calmer, more flexibility about our possible lives that we could lead, a compassion. And that's, you know, so there's a good results for me, but there's also good results for the community. And similarly, on the side of the belief in self, well, what do we have? Planning for the future, fulfillment in a vocation. How can I choose a vocation that's going to satisfy me unless I know what the me is that's going to be satisfied? And, you know, authentic action and falling in love. I mean, you know, surely I should probably know something about the temperament of the person I'm choosing to be with and my own temperament and how those things fit together. And as you say, maybe cures for cancer come out of it, but maybe there's also a certain selfishness. So how on earth do we resolve all this? What should we pick?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting that the Buddhist tradition, especially in its original form, but to some extent in the West as well, has been that, as always with these trade-offs between understanding things and making decisions, switching back and forth from one mode to another seems to be a really useful thing to do. So, say, having a retreat for a period of time in which you can not be caught up in that immediate desire to do the things that you need to do to be able to accomplish your goals, or having a meditation practice where for 20 minutes a day or an hour a day, you can release yourself, you can get out of that mode of having a self and trying to accomplish goals. I think there's an argument that then when you go back into the world of engaged action and decision making, you can do it in a better way, a less anxious way, a more effective, a more compassionate way than you would if you didn't have those experiences.
Let me ask about guilt and responsibility. I mean, those really seem connected to the idea of a continuing self and also perhaps to the idea of first-person memory. Suppose we've got somebody who's in court for a serious crime, and they bring in a Buddhist lawyer that says to the jury, now, don't base your decision on this illusion of the self. The one you see before you is just a completely different thing than the one who committed the crime. Mm-hmm. So wouldn't that be a little bit dicey?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. This actually tunes into a whole bunch of other work that we've been doing in my lab recently, looking at where our idea about free will, which is something that's very closely connected to our idea of the self, comes in. And what we found was that if you look at kids in, you know, kind of typical Western culture, there's a big connection between free will and their ability to regulate their own behavior, to do things like deferred gratification or take responsibility for their actions. But if you look at kids growing up in other cultures, you don't see that connection. So it seems as if the kids in the other cultures, so the kids in our culture have this sort of picture of conscience as you're, you know, this little person, your little free will sitting on your shoulder and telling you what to do. In other cultures, it's more like, well, there's just the right thing to do. And the right thing to do is out there in the world. It's in the social world. And you internalize, this is what the right thing to do is, without necessarily having to think, I am telling myself that this is the right thing to do.
But is there no concept of promising, for example? Right? You make a commitment, and your future self is now bound by that commitment.
Well, I think the idea, the thought is that it's more like the whole society is bound by commitments, or you're bound by commitments to your entire group, to the other people around you, rather than that it's your individual will and decision that's mm-hmm. the thing that's responsible.
But surely there's still crime in those societies, right?
Well, I mean, an interesting phenomenon, for example, is in some societies, in fact, arguably in earlier societies, if someone commits a crime, the group that they're part of can actually do something to compensate for that crime and is sort of responsible for compensating for that crime. It isn't just the individual person. So one of the ideas is that if you got rid of the sense of self, you would extend yourself to the other people around you in a way that would make you a more effective social agent. And I think we underestimate how much we do that in our everyday life anyway. It's not obvious that most of what I do is just the result of the causal properties inside of me. A lot of it depends on the context I'm in, the other people that are around me.
So we have an email, Carl Jung, but it's Y-O-U-N-G, not J-U-N-G, sent this email. Wonder if there's any connections between Hume's views on the self and his views on causation, e.g. maybe the self is an illusory cause, tying together a series of correlations that we take to be the self.
Well, I think Hume in general is a kind of anti-foundationalist. So Hume thinks in general that we have this illusion, not just the illusion of the self, but a lot of other illusions that are illusions that there's some, you know, fundamental, foundational, metaphysical reality beyond our experiences, and causality is a good example of that. But in general, you know, the idea that there's a universe that's out there that's real and is separate from and responsible for our experiences, Hume's always very skeptical about that. And it's, if you think about the philosophical tradition, I mean, Descartes, of course, is skeptical about that too. But then Descartes solves that by saying, but the one thing that you can't doubt is the fact that you're the one who's doing the thinking. And then Hume says, oh, really? You can't doubt that? Just come and try, right? Mm-hmm. Watch me. And that is another respect in which Hume is very similar to the Buddhist tradition. So the Buddhist tradition is also saying there isn't this kind of foundational thing outside of us, this reality that's other than just our experiences. And again, what both Hume and the Buddhist tradition say, and why would you want that? I mean,
but in each case, there's an interesting paradox, right? Because in Hume's case, he's proving the self doesn't exist by a causal argument. Right, he's explaining how it got to be that we have this illusion, and that's a causal argument, which he's not supposed to believe. And in the Buddhist case, they're saying, look, nothing is real, it's just in our minds. But those minds are the things that there aren't supposed to be either. So there's interesting problems here, and it sometimes seems to me as though just saying the self is an illusion isn't going to cut it. In other words, either we have to say everything is an illusion, or we can't single out selves.
Yeah, I think the Buddhist tradition and Hume, it's interesting because actually the sequences that both of them start out being skeptical about the idea that there's a world out there that's really separate from our experiences of the world. And then they start applying that idea to the self as well. So then you end up with a bunch of experiences. But again, the point that Hume has this beautiful passage where he says, then I go and play dominoes and backgammon, and I play it exactly the same way I did when I wasn't.
Yeah.
Did think that I had a self, and I pick up a glass of wine and I drink it, and that's just the same as before.
And there's also a wonderful passage in his Dialogues on Natural Religion where he essentially anticipates Darwin with a theory of evolution. You know, you got all this stuff just falling through the void, and it starts bumping into each other, and given an infinity of time, eventually these kind of things that survive, so forth and so on. And then he just says in the dialogue, I mean, his character says, but of course, there's never been enough time for that crazy idea. So that's a very naturalistic Hume with selves and the sorts of things that could have illusions coming along really late in the story, and so
everything else is real, right? Everything else was real in the way that Darwin believed.
Yeah.
It's just that this notion of self isn't real. But once you start pushing on the notion of self,
I mean, if you stick with evolution, you can have a pretty diminished sense of reality for most of the things we believe in.
That's true.
Right? They're just constructs that help them things that are themselves constructs survive. Or something like that. But anyway.
There's a little bit of interesting neuroscience about this, too. So one of the things that we know is that there's a particular brain network, the default mode network it's called, and it seems to be very much involved in our ordinary sense of ourselves. It's something that develops relatively late. It seems to be connected with some of these feelings we have about ourselves. And there are circumstances in which that default mode network, as it were, actually gets deactivated, and people report that they don't feel the same sense of self. Something we've talked about on this program before. If you look at people who have mystical experiences or who have psychedelic experiences, one of the things that's kind of interestingly characteristic of those is people saying, no, it's not just that I sort of theoretically now know that I don't have a self. I just really didn't feel it. I really felt continuous with the natural world around me or the other people around me. And again, for what it's worth, people often report that they behave better as a result of that. And Hume has this beautiful idea about morality as a matter of sentiment that's very different from the way that most philosophers think about morality, but again, very similar to the Buddhist tradition, that it's your feelings of compassion. It's that sense of really extending yourself to another person. That's the thing that's the basis for morality.
Well, Allison, you have convinced me that the self may well be an illusion, but this conversation has definitely been real. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Always great to be on Philosophy Talk.
Our guest has been Allison Gopnik, who's professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of The Philosophical Baby and How David Hume Helped Me Solve My Midlife Crisis. So, John, what's your thinking now?
Well, I'm not willing, in spite of what I said in the introduction, to say that the self is an illusion. I'm willing to say that many of the things we believe, and in particular many of the things we're taught about persons and what it is to have a self, are quite wrong. So I feel I can be
so,
in
sympathetic. So what's right?
Sympathetic.
What's the right way of thinking about it?
Well, I'm just the right way of thinking about it. It may be pretty much the way Gopnik and Buddha and Hume think about it, but I just kind of wouldn't quite say it adds up to selves being an illusion, because that's, as a philosopher of language, I think that little particle, self, that we use in himself and herself is really the basis of the whole concept.
I don't know what that means, but the conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner in our online community of thinkers, where our motto, with apologies to Descartes, is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in the community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
So you're apologizing to Descartes, but not to Hume. You're putting Descartes before de Hume. And if you have a question that wasn't addressed or mangled in today's show, or if you're bedeviled by a conundrum in your own life and could use some philosophical insight, we'd like to hear from you. Email us at conundrums@philosophytalk.org.
Now a man who never strays from his speedy selfhood, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, in the public domain, the general consensus seems to be, for those who hold consensuses about such things and perhaps stoned conversations, the soul is a nugget with no properties we can describe other than essence. And the self is layered on top of that, like a mutating oyster around a pearl. The self is your DNA, environment, race, allergies, left-handedness, weird personal habits, phobias, drive, gumption, bliss, taste in movies, personal regrets, all that stuff is the self, which we also don't really know what it is, other than it exists. Or does it? The self is relatively new. Kings did not have selves. They were bad kings or good, but they didn't take personality quizzes in women's magazines to see what type of king they were. Ditto with serfs and peasants. Their self was their station. Now, sure, sometimes a pauper might become a king, but that depended on fate, destiny, fortune, being switched at birth, killing an ogre, solving three riddles in a wood, that type of thing. We have lost destiny. Instead, today, we have life goals. TED Talks, accessories, motivational speakers, even Trump rallies, they all seem to be eggs in the same basket we used to call yearning. Now, it's just another flowchart. The self itself seems always contingent. We're self-conscious, self-aware, we have self-expression. Unlike, say, legs or puppies, the self only exists when you put a word next to it. The self is always being measured on its way to completion. It never ends. It's never fulfilled. It's like doing laps or not racing anybody. You're just doing it until you reach a number. What is measured? We do not know. The self is destroyed by observation, like subatomic particles or a second marriage. So if there is a self, it may just be a social construct or a pretty bubble created by soap and blowing or what remains of the soul after public school gets through with it. We do not know what the self is, but we are always unhappy with it. It's a fuzzy thing, kind of like the shadow of things in Plato's cave, only even dimmer. What the hell is that thing? Well, it's what we could be if we were self-improved. It's the selves we see on a movie screen. I could be that guy if I had superpowers and a gun. Not that we admire movie stars necessarily, but we can identify with this truncated, flashy version of life over in 2 hours. Lessons learned, happiness achieved, or death achieved, depending. And now we don't even need to leave the house to get that. Movie's right there on the couch with the unexamined self to join you as you gawk at the all-too-examined selves on the screen. There's a self at which we never arrive. Kind of like the signs telling us how many miles we have left to go before we hit Disneyland. Then we finally get to Disneyland, and it's still not Disneyland, just pieces of it, this ride or that. We don't have the time or the money to see it all. The totality of Disneyland will ever elude us. If the world, like the self, would just land on our head or conversely leave us completely alone, we would know. We would come into ourselves at last and know, or at least have a pretty good idea for a movie, if we can just get somebody to help us write it. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2020.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from our partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Josh Landy. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.